This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Hello and welcome. I'm Natalie Pinsham, and I'll be reading synopses of five articles published on December 19th, 2014. The topics of the articles featured in this podcast are vascular disorders, Chiari malformation, anatomy, and epilepsy. Spontaneous subarachnoid hemorrhage of unknown origin. Hospital course and long-term clinical and angiographic follow-up. A clinical article by Ali El-Hodi and colleagues. Subarachnoid hemorrhage with an unidentifiable source is a benign condition whose initial clinical outcomes are well documented. However, long-term clinical and angiographic outcomes remain unknown. The purpose of this study was to evaluate the long-term clinical and angiographic outcomes in patients with such lesions. The Barrow Ruptured Aneurysm Trial enrolled 472 patients. Etiology of the hemorrhage was not identified during the initial hospitalization in 100 patients. 56 patients had no known cause of bleeding. The source of bleeding was identified within 6 weeks follow-up. However, imaging beyond 6 weeks did not reveal a source of hemorrhage in any patient. Hydrocephalus requiring ventriculoperitoneal shunt placement occurred in 7% of patients, and delayed cerebral ischemia occurred in 7%. At the 3-year follow-up, 9% of patients had poor outcomes, with an average modified Rankine scale score of less than 2. Initial bleeding pattern and admission Hunt and Hess score are significant determinants of clinical outcome and length of hospital stay. Authors of this study concluded that outcomes are typically good in patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage of unknown etiology. Nonetheless, hydrocephalus and delayed cerebral ischemia do occur, and some patients will suffer a poor outcome. Follow-up imaging in the first 6 weeks is critical to rule out vascular lesions, but imaging beyond 6 weeks post-ictus has little utility. Intraoperative somatosensory evoked potential recovery following opening of the fourth ventricle during posterior fossa decompression in Chiari malformation. A case report by Stefan Grossauer and co-authors. The most appropriate surgical technique for posterior fossa decompression in Chiari malformation remains controversial. The use of electrophysiological studies during posterior fossa decompression for Chiari type 1 malformation aims to shed light on the ideal extent of decompression. The existing reports on this issue state that significant improvement of somatosensory evoked potentials occurs after craniotomy in all cases, but that the addition of a durotomy contributes a further improvement in only a minority of cases. This implies that craniotomy alone might suffice for clinical improvement, avoiding the need for duroplasty or even subarachnoid manipulation at the level of the craniocervical junction. In contrast to published data, the authors describe the case of a 32-year-old woman with Chiari malformation and extensive cervicothoracic syringomyelia. During surgery, her intraoperative somatosensory evoked potentials did not notably improve after craniotomy or after durotomy. They only improved after opening of the fourth ventricle and restoration of cerebrospinal fluid flow through the foramen of Magendi. Postoperatively, the patient recovered completely from preoperative neurological deficits. This is the first report of significant somatosensory evoked potentials recovery after opening the fourth ventricle in Chiari type 1 malformation decompression. It is concluded that there might be a subset of patients with Chiari type 1 malformation who require subarachnoid dissection at the level of the craniocervical junction to benefit clinically. Relationship of vocal cord paralysis to the coil diameter of vagus nerve stimulator leads. A clinical article by Leslie Robinson and Ken Winston. The relationship of vocal cord paralysis to the inner diameter of the coils used to attach stimulator leads to vagus nerves was investigated using data collected by the manufacturer as mandated by the Food and Drug Administration. Vocal cord paralysis was reported in 193 of 51,882 implantations. The incidence of vocal cord paralysis across all age groups increased with age at implantation for leads having 2 mm coils. Among patients 18 years of age and older, the incidence of paralysis was 0.26% in those whose stimulator leads had coil diameters of 3 mm, but was 0.51% in those whose stimulator leads had the 2 mm coils. The authors discuss possible explanations for this relationship. Although the incidence of vocal cord paralysis is low in patients with each of the coil diameters, this complication is severe in all age groups. Venous organization in the transverse foramen. Dissection, histology, and magnetic resonance imaging. A laboratory investigation by Elsa Magro and co-workers. Precise knowledge of the anatomical arrangement of the venous system within the transverse foramen is necessary in imaging when vertebral artery dissection is suspected, as well as in surgical approaches for the cervical spine. This anatomical and radiological study aimed to better explain the anatomical organization of the venous system within the transverse foramen according to the Trollard hypothesis of vertebral transverse sinus. 10 cadaveric specimens were analyzed after vascular injection, and high-resolution magnetic resonance imaging studies with two-dimensional time-of-flight segment MR venography sequences were performed in 10 healthy volunteers. Vertebral veins are arranged in a plexiform manner within the transverse canal. This arrangement begins at the upper part of the transverse canal before the vertebral vein turns into a single vein along with the vertebral artery running from the transverse foramen of the 6th cervical vertebra. This venous system runs somewhat ventrolaterally to the vertebral artery. In most cases, this arrangement is symmetrical and facilitates radiological readings. The anastomoses between vertebral veins and ventral longitudinal veins are uniform and are arranged segmentally at each vertebra. It is hard to come up with a common description of the arrangement of vertebral veins. The authors suggest providing clinicians as well as anatomists with a well-detailed description of components essential to the understanding of this organization. Integrated open surgical and endovascular embolization treatment of a paracavernous venous plexus fistula. A case report by Justin Dye and colleagues. Paracavernous venous plexus fistulas can mimic carotid cavernous fistulas in both radiographic and clinical presentation. The location of this rare type of fistula limits its endovascular access. The authors report on an integrated open surgery and endovascular embolization approach to a paracavernous venous plexus fistula. They review the pertinent literature. A 66-year-old man presented with right eye chemosis. Cerebral angiography confirmed an arteriovenous shunt of the right paracavernous venous plexus. Attempts at both transvenous and transarterial embolization were unsuccessful. Subsequently, an intradural pretemporal approach to the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus was performed. Using neuronavigation, registered to a preoperative CT angiogram, the location of the paracavernous venous plexus was identified. Next, a spinal needle was stereotactically guided into the fistula. Intraoperative angiograms through the spinal needle and through transfemoral access were used to confirm the location of the spinal needle inside the fistula and outside the adjacent internal carotid artery. Onyx was then injected into the fistula under fluoroscopic visualization. Intraoperative and 3-month follow-up angiograms confirmed complete resolution of the fistula. A detailed knowledge of the venous pathways surrounding the cavernous sinus is important when planning and executing the treatment of these rare vascular lesions. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.